carbon basis compared to natural gas. For CO2 is not really an issue here in the United States, but for global warming, what the skipping from oil is that we move very hard on global warming. The CO2 emissions, oil demand will very likely increase, at least in the short term, as we move away from coal and move to oil and gas, which is very much for other choices. But as I said, in the United States, this issue is really less important for global warming. One of the reasons it's less important is because our transportation sector, which really doesn't have any ready substitutes, emits almost as much carbon dioxide as our power needs. Our attention is focused on transportation because in transportation, nitrous oxides and reactive hydrocarbons, which contribute to low-level ozone, are very important. These are being addressed with Clean Air Act. Theory about turning motor fuels, more efficient vehicles, and we think that this is very likely to continue to be an emphasis. CAFE standards are very likely to increase in the coming years. So the environmental issues in the long term are very likely going to push down on oil. In the near term, depending on how hard we push on the environment, oil demand can go up. But it does provide a ceiling on prices. Another thing that the environmental issues are doing, and we're seeing that today, is the price differential between these good quality crude oils, light sweet crude oils like WTI, North Sea Brent, versus heavier, more sour crudes like Saudi production, Venezuela production, to some extent Alaskan production. Is the differential is wider because the market is demanding cleaner fuels, fuels that contain less residual fuel oil, or oils that contain less refined products that contain less sulfur. And refiners really have only two options: either invest in conversion capacity to destroy the residual fuel oil, or to refine lighter, sweeter crude oils. At least temporarily, for the near term, the choice is to buy lighter crude oil. No one really seems to be making a very big effort right now, with the exception of the OPEC producers, of investing in conversion capacity. Not very many OECD countries are building much conversion capacity right now. The choice seems to be looking out ahead and just saying, we're going to buy oil. We don't know if the markets will be stable to invest in conversion capacity. This is another goal or another reason why OPEC's goal is to maintain stable prices, stimulate investment. Not only investment in refining to deal with their oil, but also investment in exploration and production to get companies to come in for guarantees. I think with that, I'm going to stop and turn it over to Odd Hassel.
Okay, I was just wondering, maybe would you like to go through some questions right now? Or?
Yeah, I think
there may be some questions. Let me just start off. I appreciate the world update on where we're going. Obviously, the question that we always asked during the legislative session the last 60 days is where the price of oil is going to go. I think you've given us a pretty good idea of the playing field of where it's going to be. Do you think that there's a pretty good ability that's going to be stable in the next 18 months? Because our budget is based on everything from July of 1990 all the way through next year. So that's really about a 16 to 18 month period that we're concerned about. And can we reasonably base our budget on $18 or $19 a barrel and be safe to say that that's what it's going to be?
We don't see very much downside risk in prices, maybe just in the short term, between now and mid-second quarter. Otherwise, we think the price will either be stable with possible upside volatility, especially as you get out into the fourth quarter. You have to be careful that the late first quarter and early second quarters are typically a time of price weakness anyway. That's a traditional sense, or the traditional track record. We see that happening again. One thing that I should point out is that as we come into an era of increasing capacity constraints, there could be a return to the old seasonality in oil prices and oil demand that we had back in the 60s and 70s, and very characteristic of the price cycles we see for American natural gas. That is, prices will tend to spike more in the fourth quarter and in the first quarter during periods of high demand and constraint, production constraint, infrastructure constraint, and then come off again in the late first and second quarter. So as far as our outlook goes, we don't see a lot of downside risk. Prices will probably trend $18 OPEC oil a little higher. But there is some weakness still in the next month or so.
Second question is, and I think the figure was correct when I was at Cambridge Energy Research Conference in Houston, that we in the United States are importing a greater share of oil from foreign sources. That figure is anywhere between 46 and 47 or 48%. I understand you think that that's going to increase in the 1990s where we will be over 50% as far as dependence on foreign oil in the United States?
I think it's very likely you'll see a 50% import dependency. The key point here is that it's very likely crude oil that gains, crude oil imports. In the last 2 or 3 years, the key gain here has been by Middle East producers. Saudi Arabia, for example, was down to a low of 25,000 barrels a day in the U.S. They're now well over a million barrels a day average in the U.S. It's very likely that that's going to continue, and it will be the long haul producers that will benefit. I think it's very possible to see the 50%. It's a psychological barrier as well. We have hit 50% on a very short-term basis in the past 3 or 4 months. Anywhere, I believe.
Steve?
A couple questions. I guess, excuse me, a little over a year ago, we were looking at a price, I don't know, somewhere probably $12, $13 a barrel, and now we're looking at $18 to $20, and I don't have a good sense of what has changed so dramatically to change the price so much. Is it, excuse me, are the capacities so constrained that they can't expand? I mean, you've talked somewhat about capacities. I guess I've always been under the impression that Saudi Arabia kind of had a spigot over there, and they could turn it up to 11 million if they wanted to, or cut it back to 5 if demand didn't support a higher figure. And so I guess I'm kind of confused on why the thing has changed so dramatically in the course of a year. And maybe you can help me with that.
Sure. There have been a few developments. The first one is the strength of demand. A lot of people underestimate the strength of demand, particularly in the Far East and in developing countries. And that's really adding a nice floor over oil prices. The second major factor has been just the rate of decline in U.S. production. In 1989, I believe we were down almost 500,000 barrels a day. So because of a big drop in oil supply in the world market, it has to come from someplace else. Another factor was, I think it was generally believed in the industry that there was a good supply, a good capacity cushion in the Middle East. I'll give you an example. Saudi Arabia's capacity is probably about 6 million barrels a day right now. Middle East is 5.4. So there isn't much of a ceiling there. They used to have a lot of production capacity. But through the 1980s, when they didn't need it, it tended to be neglected. Also, they didn't do the development. There apparently was no need. The capacity constraints are important, not so much for what's going to happen tomorrow, or next month, or even next quarter. What the capacity constraints are important for is that the lead time that it takes to bring on more capacity may not be enough time for the rate of increase that we're seeing in demand. That's the concern. The concern is that when we get out to 1993, 1994, then we won't have that capacity. And that when the call on world oil supplies, it may exceed the ability of the system to produce the oil. And we see two major developments happening here. First, more production capacity and more dollars flowing into that sector. And secondly, a possible change in oil inventory patterns on the part of the major producers and companies. You're starting to see that now, the very increased interest in mothballed Caribbean storage facilities and transshipment plants. A lot of Venezuela, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait are now very interested in increasing their ability to store oil to supply short-haul markets under short notice to help handle demand surges. So the things that have changed in the last year or so are the decline in production in the U.S., demand growth, and this perception that we are rapidly losing our capacity margin. And that capacity margin and other things that are fueling it is not only the crude production. That's the one we focus on the most because it's very visible. But as Bob will talk about oil tankers, we're seeing it in the refining system. 3 or 4 years ago, we had an accident in a refinery here in the United States. Probably didn't have done a whole lot to price. We saw what's happened on several occasions in the last 2 years where an accident in a refinery is set to mark very high. And there's a psychological prop there that we're running at a very tight system.
Can I follow up with one? Senator Frank, another question, then we're going to need to keep moving along if there's other people, too, that want to...
And you're suggesting that because of financial constraints and the need to invest capital to achieve additional capacity and the constraints on that we aren't going to see a rush to increase capacity on the part of OPEC and into overcapacity?
I think the goal there is to maintain a capacity margin. I think the concern right now of overbuilding is very small. now the issue is to get more capacity online, get the dollars flowing in, and they're starting to. Almost every producer has either changed a policy to get things going, or is doing it themselves. There is just a tremendous interest going on right now in most of these countries, and globally. If you look at U.S. offshore day rates just on drilling rates, they've more than doubled. And if you look at what the cost is to bring a new one online, it's like 10 times what the day rate is right now. We're not only stretching those facilities, production, refining, transportation, we're stretching our ability to to drill for oil, because that has been slumped as well. So personnel, equipment, those things are also becoming in short supply as demand for that oil increases. The activity is really picking up.
Good, thank you.
Just one last, are there other questions for Kevin? I know that one thing they did mention, the Secretary General of OPEC did mention, is that they were going to increase their capacity in OPEC countries in the 1990s by, I don't know, $250 billion or $400 or $500 billion, just to increase the capacity of refining and delivery of that oil. And if they didn't do that, you would see a price that would go way up there, because the system worldwide could not handle the demand that's going to occur in the 1990s. In fact, it was my understanding, and we need to double check on it, that with the North Sea production, that just the North Sea production, just by the number of new cars that were going to go on the road in the 1990s, would be absorbed by what the North Sea could produce. Ah, did you want to start?
Do you want me to start commenting on the North Sea production outlook and the number of cars in Europe, or should we leave that as an open question to come back to? The production in the North Sea is certainly on the rise, both in the short term and in the medium term, due to the recovery after all the accidents that we've had in the British sector last year. And the Norwegian part of the production is certainly on an increase, and we're nearing a plateau. On the cars in Europe, I will not comment on that now. I would like to start off by saying that I'm very honored to be here, pleased to be here, and I hope you will excuse me for sitting here, as I don't have any overheads to show you. I will try to keep you concentrated on what I'm saying, and hope that we will manage to do that. Being a Norwegian carrying an American passport, I feel at home here, even though it's my first time to Juneau. I'm very happy to be here. The thing I'm going to talk about now is trying to lift the views a little bit longer term than with direct implications for the next budget term. Most of the things that I will talk about is linking into the elements that Kevin just went through, but I'm talking about the tanker market development strategies and the linkage to the oil market. For the influence of the next budget term, let me first say that I do not see any dramatic change in the average transportation cost, tanker transportation cost, over the next 18 to 24 months. We have a normal volatility in that market, and as an illustration, the rates are moving, fluctuating at about 50% for average transportation cost, Middle East Gulf to the US Gulf, meaning an average between $1-$1.50 a barrel. That fluctuation indicates that we're closer to capacity constraints also in the short term. What I would like to start off with is to go through the three key issues I see linking to all parts of the energy business, and more specifically, the tanker industry. The first one being environmental concerns, which I call the challenge. The second one being demand versus capacity, which I call the race. And the third being the new world, which is to think the unthinkable. Let me start off with the environmental concerns and the challenge on that one. It is quite obvious that something has to be done and that something will be done. I see the risks here and the risks both for the industry and for the politicians. The risks are linked to the uncertainties. What do we know? What do we believe? What has to be done, or what can be done? I will come back to that element when I talk more specifically about tanker regulations and tanker legislations. The actions what are the options of actions we have there? We have the preventive measures. That means that we will try to either reduce pollution or reducing the risk of pollution. Or we have the other part of the picture, the cleaning up process. When a pollution first had taken place, how is our emergency preparedness system? How is our liability system developed? Who's going to pay for it? And how quickly will it happen? I talk about this in very general terms now, and I assume that we all in the room start thinking about the tragic Exxon Valdez accident last year and can link the preventive measures and the cleaning up measures into that example. Now, all environmental issues does have a cost and a benefit issue linked to it. The problem with the global energy issues are that we see the benefits in the longer term, but I do assume that we're fully seeing the benefits of both preventive measures and cleanup actions in the short term due to the accidents having taken place. It does, however, have serious implications into the economic developments and the welfare of the people, short term and longer term. And it is a question whether this is in sometimes in contradiction to each other. That brings to the clear and very difficult element of who is footing that bill. Eventually, so it's the consumers that have to pay the bill, but eventually mean at some stage. Because we have to look at the alternatives for an efficient funding of the preventive as well as the cleaning up measures to take place. And a final note of the challenge of the environmental concerns. Environmental issues are of a global nature as well as a regional nature. And we have to see it interlinked and to see that the measures we take regional are linked into the global situation. And it's obvious that a need for international agreements and the use of international organizations are very important, and especially so when we look into the part of the industry, which is the tanker industry, which in its nature is truly global. Let me then move to the second item, which Kevin has touched upon in the oil market short to medium term. Demand versus capacity. This race is taking place throughout the whole energy scene. It's not only in the oil, it's not only in oil production, refining, transportation. It's linked into the oil fuels, and it's linked into electricity production capacity. In many ways, you can all link this into the age structure of the existing capacity. That goes for tankers, it goes for refineries, and it goes for also the production capacity to a certain extent. This capacity were mainly built up during the early 70s, and it was scaled down, trimmed down, in the early 80s. It gives an age structure of the capacity that is imbalanced, and we are, especially in the tanker industry, facing a period where whatever we think about new requirements, there is a need for a significant renewal of the tanker fleet. The environmental issues add constraints to the capacity and add new requirements for capacity that we are uncertain whether we can meet. Do we have the facilities to meet those requirements? Before I will touch more on that, just let me give a few comments about the new world, which is then the global surrounding influencing all the elements of this market development. To think the unthinkable can just be reflecting to the East European development over the last 6 months, or to the development in the Soviet Union itself, or on the contrary element, the development in China last year. This has major implications on the short-term outlook for the oil and energy markets, but it has much more implications on the longer-term outlook, both on the potential increase in demand, but also on the potential constraints on the capacity and demand for more capacity, paralleling that with the obvious capacity that can come on stream there. First, there is an enormous need for replacement of new equipment in Eastern Europe and Soviet Union that will put constraints on the current capacity available. But secondly, they have a potentially large capacity to supply the world with tankers and other equipment as soon as they get their capacity on stream with Western technologies. Moving these general elements into the strategies in the tanker industry for the 1990s and linking then that into the environmental considerations. The key issue now is security of supply of a different type than the security of supply we had in the late 70s, early 80s. Now it's a security of supply of available capacity from the right quality that can handle the fuels with a minimum of damages for the environment. The constraints, as we have touched upon during the question about the reserves and the production capacity in OPEC countries, is whether it's the capacity or the capital that will be real limitations on the market development. Because when we add up all these requirements for investments during the next 3 to 5 to 10 years, we add up all the elements in the oil chain and the energy picture in itself globally, environmental issues coming in there, we see a significant constraint on the financial markets, which means money is becoming more expensive. It will be a demand increase in the financial market, which really will compete with then the demand for new capacity and constrain the implementation of the new capacity. All the environmental issues that we can think about will add to this already tight situation. We all know that capacity is available at a price, and that's the key issue, at a price. To link that into the tanker situation, the average age of the current tanker fleet is some 13, 14 years. The average age of the large tankers is higher. Of the current capacity of new buildings, most of that capacity, and all of the capacity for building large tankers, is blocked through 1992. Filled with orders for deliveries of new vessels. This in a situation where new building prices over the last year have gone up with 10 to 15%, more than doubled since 85, but we should remember that the new building prices in today's market is not more than 20% above the new building prices of 1981 in nominal US dollars. There's been a tremendous development during the 1980s with the ups and downs in tanker industry and new building costs, as well as we've seen it in the price of oil. Having that in the perspective for looking into the environmental considerations and those things that I know that you're very concerned about here. The uncertainties on requirements and legislations. The environmental issues and economic growth, will they work together? Can they work together? The opinion polls that Kevin referred to shows that there is a general belief that it's possible. And we have to hope that that is possible, because we need the economic growth to be able to pay the bill for the environmental improvements. The environmental drive for improved energy efficiency is the safe measure in the environmental picture. That will have an impact on demand and on the fuel choices, and will affect also the oil industry. The environmental issues linked to tanker situation is then linked into a key common word of today, double bottom, double hull. That puts all of the tanker issue into one common familiar name. I do have to stress, though, that there are an enormous amount of various measures, preventive measures, that need to be remembered alongside with the discussion of double bottom, double hull. I'll revert to that in a second, but first go through then some of the key issues on double bottom, double hull requirements. Double bottom seems to be a measure that is so easy to recognize that it is a need to try to implement it the sooner the better. The question is, at what cost? And another question is, will it really help? Is it a good measure to show that something's done, or is it a real improvement of the safety at sea? Will it help reducing the possibility of oil spills? And as you are aware of, there is very strong feelings around in the industry and among politicians and participants linked into this question throughout the world, not only in the United States and in Alaska. The experts are in disagreement. And they try to confuse the picture by having various actors in the market doing the normal lobbying activity and saying that either the one or the other is the perfect solution. We know that a double bottom can in some instances be explained as being helpful. But during the accident scenarios, you can see that 3 out of 5 potential accidents could be worse with double bottom than without. Leaving that aside for a second, the double bottom requirement and double hull requirement does have its price. In today's market, it doesn't seem to be too bad, because calculation, given that you do have the capacity, indicates that a new building price of a tanker with a double bottom, double hull will go up with some 10 to 20%. And looking into the freight element of this means that you can calculate in today's market that the freight element of this could be in the range of 15 to 13 cents a barrel. Now I leave all the technical discussion about what, whether it's a good or a bad measure aside. That doesn't seem to be that an enormous amount of money, and doesn't seem to have that implication on the price of oil. However, thinking back to what I said about the capacity versus demand, and the total pressure in the market due to environmental considerations and pressure into the financial market, due to the capacity constraints on all elements throughout the industry. A requirement for implementing double bottom, double hull now will put a significant pressure on a new building capacity that is already filled up for the next couple of years. When demand goes up in an already tight market, there's only one way out of it: price increases. That means that the calculations done today of a 10 to 20% increase in new building costs, or a 15 to 30 cent increase in transportation cost per barrel, could well be fooling us into believing that this is not that much of a price element. It could well be doubled or tripled, depending on the full implementation of that. That is not to say that it's not coming. Most likely it will come. But the important thing is that it will come in an orderly way, whereby it's possible to have it implemented and to have it evaluated and run through the technical alternatives, so that what is implemented is something that all participants within the industry and the community can live with. But looking at then the preventive measures, because that's what we're talking about here, we should remember that in the tanker industry, we have to look at A, the vessel traffic systems in difficult waters. That's a preventive measure that can much more easily be implemented. We have to look to that the standards of the vessels currently operating is met and kept. And that's going to the classification societies and the flag states operations. And that links not only then to the American flag vessels, but also to foreign flag vessels. We have to look at the qualifications on the manning of vessels to see that the standards of the crew are having some minimum certificates set. These preventive measures could have a much more important impact to prevent pollution than any technical requirement for the new buildings. In any case, the technical requirements for new buildings will take many years to be implemented. some 85% of the recorded accidents of oil pollution from vessels are based on human errors in one way or another. Then to go to the measures when first, or the question, when the accident's first there, who's paying and what do we do with it? That means the liability question. And all these proposals for increased liability throughout the whole system that's been put forward both here and on the federal level and also being discussed on international levels, they will eventually increase the transportation costs. No doubt about it. On the other hand, they are all, with some reservation I will come back to in a second again, they're all playing a part in also being preventive in the way that if you have the liability question set, it will cost money to comply with it, and it will force then more security measures in the transportation and operation of tankers. Running through all the various liability issues, there is one element that I would like to stress. It does not concern any of the issues that I found put forward in the Alaskan proposals, but it concerns the proposal of the US Congress, the Senate and the House proposals. And that goes for the question about unlimited liability. Because in the proposals, there is a notion of unlimited liability if there are some sort of errors that is easy to classify as can be defined to whatever has happened. Let me put forward here, an unlimited liability is impossible to make insurance against. And if the owner, operator, and companies cannot make an insurance at a price for a high liability, but not for an unlimited liability, then you push for single unit operating companies. And you push out of the market the serious integrated companies that could perform quality services. Then to come back to the question about the liabilities in an international scene. There are international agreements put forward through the International Maritime Organization for securing the liability question of tanker operations. Those measures are very important, and the reason for that is that if state or national legislation are put forward that not is taken care of in other parts of the world, you get a changing competitive situation. And that is important to take care of when looking at the world oil and tanker market. And in that respect, to be sure that the liability question gets as much spread around the globe as possible and then as an even high level that used across the system. So put the state federal systems into an international perspective and work through the international bodies. To conclude, the tanker transportation situation looking towards the mid-90s and throughout the 1990s, the tanker transportation cost will increase significantly with or without the environmental issues. The environmental issues for safe transportation of oil will have to be taken, but for oil producers and oil consumers, we have to look at and hope for that they are implemented in a way which is technically possible to carry through. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Duncan, did you have any questions?
No.
Senator Fisher?
I just have one thought about transportation cost increase is going to happen anyhow. What did you expect or give a guess? In other words, if it's going to happen anyhow, what about the double haul, if that's required? What about the liability, if it is unlimited liability? Price per barrel, do you have any kind of guesses as to what
Well,
taking the worst case first. The worst case could be that you won't have any capacity to transport the oil required by the United States if a double hull requirement is put in today. There's been discussion about retrofitting the existing large tankers. To make a comparison, if you take a 14-story building, I don't know if I have some in my surroundings here, but try to figure out a 14-story building. And think about building a new full basement into that. That means you jack it up, put a new full basement in under that building. That's approximately the same task as retrofitting a very large crude carrier with a new double bottom. It will take between 9 months and 2 years to get it done at any U.S. yard. And you are linked for the American flag vessels with the Jones Act requirement to the U.S. yard capacity.
For Alaskan crude, you mean? For
now I'm talking about Alaskan crude going to California, for example, where you have the Jones Act requirement for American flag vessels. That illustrates that if the worst comes to the worst, you won't see any limits to the price increase because you won't have the capacity. You asked me for a worst case scenario. Having the requirement that all vessels will have to be replaced within 7 years with double bottom, 15 years with double hull, as an illustration of the proposal that's there, and say, as from now. It is probably easy to see that it can be complied with on the international tanker market, where you don't have the requirement to build it in the U.S., than for the U.S. fleet with the requirement to build it in the U.S. because of the existing capacity. So when worst come to the second worst, that means looking apart from the retrofitting, it can be still very difficult for just the capacity for U.S. fleet. Looking then at the global worst scenarios about the implication on dollars per barrel, we see a fluctuation now of, say, 50 cents per barrel, dollar to dollar 50, just to the close capacity utilization at peak periods. When you are in a capacity, full capacity utilization tank rates, they just skyrocket. There are no limits to that. But putting in dollar and cents, looking towards mid-90s to give you a figure, I would talk more about the $3 per barrel than significantly much more.
So it could cost as much as $3 a barrel on the cost of transportation costs for, in general, or what? I mean, particularly between Valdez and, let's say, Cherry Point.
I did not talk about the Alaskan oil here. I took an example, a general reference figures in the oil transportation, Middle East crude to U.S. Gulf.
I see.
Linked into the general, where we have now the transportation cost $1, $1.50, depending on where you are on the seasonal peaks. And you can double that, but you can have volatility on that. That can really push it up during then the peak capacity.
Would you also say, from what I understand, if there's going to be more environmental constraints on tankers and the requirements are going to be stiffer and the cost for transportation could go up by $3 a barrel, would that not make more valuable land transportation oil, like oil that's produced in Texas, Oklahoma, Louisiana, versus a requirement that we have to maintain in Alaska because we have no other choice but to ship it on the open seas? That'll bring the price of Texas crude up, so they'll actually be making that extra amount of money on their fuel, whereas we're just going to all pay it in transportation costs.
Well, to put that is one of those implications that I think you will be looking very carefully at. And that's the implication on the increased transportation costs. And the longer of the haul, the more influence you get of this. That means that the Middle East crudes will see the highest transportation costs element in their SIF, their landed price in the U.S. Gulf, for example. Which goes for then the WTI, for example. They have an additional element of linking, but it's more important for comparable crudes with short-haul supply, as, for example, the ANS.
Senator Fisher, any other questions?
No, the only other concern I had is, I thought I heard you say that, I don't know how many these pillars you looked at, 3 out of 5, the business is worse if the tank had a double haul.
Yes.
I guess the problem is we all assume that a double hull will always minimize the amount of stowage. And what I hear you saying is not true.
Well, that's where I try to make that not as my firm view. I gave it as the analysis made by these technical experts. The problem with the double bottom, that was double bottom requirement, is that when you ground, and we're talking the large vessels, and let me give a note here, the smaller vessels, the vessels with the chemicals, should be looked into the barges, those vessels where you have a much easier calculation of the effect of the double hull, and during a grounding, the influence of water into the double hull doesn't have that major negative effect as the water into a double hull on a very large crude tankers because of the amount of oil and the volumes involved here. Because the double bottom of a very large crude carrier, if you ground with that double bottom, and it's a question of how thick the double bottom should be, and if you make it too thick for safety measures, you get an instability of the vessel. That means that you increase the risk of accidents in itself, but you have to have it a certain minimum layer in there, and if you ground that vessel, you get water inside that double hull, double bottom space. You ground it, and you get stuck on the reef. If you have a single skin tanker going, grounding on the reef, you have a leakage of some amount of oil, can be absolutely a disaster in itself, and we know that, but there comes the other preventive measures that could be taken in an emergency. But that's the leakage, and the tanker get afloat. With a double bottom, you're stuck. You had no leakage initially if you didn't go through the double. If the weather is bad, the tanker's stuck, and you risk a total loss. And then you have the total amount of oil coming out, and not the partial amount of oil. And those are the scenarios that these technical experts have run through and seen that the grounding effect is getting difficult, more difficult in 3 out of 5 cases. Whether the weather condition will mean that you get a total loss or not is an open question.
Any other questions? Well, we sure appreciate you being here today, and thank you for your update. And I think we're going to be meeting with other legislators individually, so... we sure appreciate your presentation, and thank you. That'll conclude our meeting for today. Bill number 311, basically because we've got some people on teleconference here, and the mayor, evidently primarily the mayor from Whittier, and then we have about 4 or 5 people to testify, and I would assume we'll have that taken care of by about 9:30, and then maybe Senator Frank will be here, because we originally had scheduled the meeting for 9:30, and since we've got so much on the docket, we would start with 311. We're just waiting for Senator Duncan. If you want, you can come up and have a seat. Oh, we have Senator Frank here, so we can start. I apologize about moving the meeting up, but we've got about 15 bills on the calendar this morning, and we need to utilize our time. So we'll get started this morning, and today is Thursday, March 15th, 1990. And if you would use your microphones for the mayor of Whittier, who's on board,
The first bill that we're going to take up this morning because of time will be committee substitute for House Bill 311, Transportation. It's the third bill on the list, and it is an act approving the issuance of revenue bonds for construction of a road from Portage to Whittier and of Bradfield River Resource Road and providing for an effective date. And if you would turn to your handout on that. And we have Representative Cabina here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to be real brief. I know there's a number of people. Just to let you know, this is a bill that Representative Cato introduced last year. The House Transportation Committee has been studying the Whittier Road for about 4 years. I'm speaking mainly on the Whittier Road part of this and not the Bradfield, but House Transportation has been studying this, trying to get transportation and road access into Whittier. Whittier is the only incorporated city in the state of Alaska that does not have road access or a state-maintained airport. I'd like to say that the people of Whittier support almost unanimously this road. This booklet that I have right here, you'll notice signatures that were collected at a boat show in Anchorage, mostly people from Anchorage, supporting a road for Whittier. You know, we have some controversial roads. Some roads are controversial. This one here really is not. The railroad supports building this road. They would use basically the second tunnel going into Whittier as a dual access tunnel. What this bill does is really, it sets up in statute allowing the government to issue $27 million for the Whittier Road. But really what that means is that not that we'll just go out and sell revenue bonds immediately. It means that there's three hurdles that have to be completed. DOT would submit to the governor and the legislature a feasibility study that finds the project financially feasible and able to produce revenue adequate to repay the bonds, number one. Number two, if financing in addition to the revenue bonds is required to finance the toll facility, the department then submits to the governor and the legislature a finance plan that includes an estimate of the total cost of the toll facility and a description of sources of money that will be used to finance the total cost of the toll facility. And three, the Office of Management and Budget reviews the feasibility study and finance plan, if required, and reports its findings and recommendations to the governor within 90 days. So, in essence, this bill really only has a $100,000 fiscal note. I believe $30,000 of that would be to do the Whittier study, the other $70,000 to do the Bradfield study. And DOT would do that and report back to us, so it's really not a bill that is saying we're automatically spending $27 million on these things. And I'm going to leave my comments real brief like that, Mr. Chairman, unless you have questions of me specifically.
Are there questions? No questions. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, sir.
Cabina. The next person to testify will be Georgia Bach, the mayor of Whittier. And do you hear us, Georgia?
I sure do. Thank you.
Okay, go ahead and proceed, Mayor.
Good morning. I would like to give you some facts that we here in Whittier feel are very important for this road. First of all, the economic growth of the city is at stake. The railroad owns approximately 75% of the commercial land in Whittier. I believe there's nothing to expand on. If we do get the road through to Whittier, it enables us to develop Shotgun Cove, which is going to be a large recreational area, and the social impact or the economic impact would be terrific. Another thing that we've had problems with are the priorities given by the railroad. And I'm not sure that you're aware of these, but first-come, first-served basis is people that have confirmed tickets on the ferry. Second priority on the list are buses, which have 15 passengers or more. Third is perishable food items, which we feel is not very fair. We have strangled our fishing export out of Whittier because of the high cost, and we feel that a road would reduce these prices so that we get more efficient growth. Representative Cabino has already mentioned the fact that we're the only incorporated city that does not have a state-funded road nor a state-funded airport. Right now, we're pretty dependent on the railroad and how they operate. We used to have a lot of people come into Whittier for weekends, families that came to go fishing or to pick blueberries. Because of the high cost of transportation on the railroad, those people avoid us like the plague. $64 round trip for a car and driver plus an additional for each passenger makes it almost prohibitive for those people to come and visit us. And we feel something needs to be done so that we can develop the economic growth and make us self-existing.
Thank you, Mayor. Mayor, are there questions from senators on the Finance Committee? No questions. Thank you. At this time, we'll take testimony here from Juneau. First person to testify on House Bill 311 is Todd Nottingham. Mr. Nottingham.
Mr. Chairman, how do I
just a little butt forward there?
Just like it. Mr. Chairman, my name is Todd Nottingham. I work for Pradovich, Nottingham, and Drage. We're local engineers here in town. My name is Todd Nottingham. I work for Pradovich, Nottingham, and Drage here in town. We also have an office in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm here in place of Dennis Nottingham, who's out of town. Dennis Nottingham is president of Pradovich, Nottingham, and Drage, and a member of the Alaska Road Association, and also the Highway Users Federation. He's done extensive study on the Whittier Road portion of it, and I'm basically here to talk about the feasibility of that road. I believe you have a map that's in front of you. It basically depicts the most feasible route that for the Whittier Road. It basically starts at the U.S. Forest Service viewing station at the Portage Lake site. This visitor site is accessible from the Sterling Highway, okay, a short distance away. A bridge would pass in back of the visitor center, crossing Portage Creek. Small stretch of road would extend into Bear Valley, where another small creek would be crossed with a bridge, and then a short drive to the existing railroad tunnel that accesses into Whittier itself, and a short stretch of road on the other side in the Whittier would connect into existing roads. Now, the access through the railroad tunnel, the tunnel would have to be modified slightly, but it would not, does not really pose any real major technical problems. It's foreseen, or in this study that we've looked at, the rail, it would just be a one-way traffic, so you'd need guide cars, signalization, that kind of thing. Lighting would need to be provided along the tunnel. Paving and drainage through the tunnel and modification of the railroad tracks so that the railroad continue to operate. Tunnel ventilation, it seems to be a major concern from what I've heard. Dennis Nottingham, working with Friar Presley, mechanical engineer in Anchorage, has come up with a scheme that is feasible and really would only represent maybe 20% of the cost of the project. We estimate the cost of the project at about $16 million in total construction cost, covering engineering and any construction contingency, and add another $4 million would make it about a $20 million project for this facility, as we've shown on this concept plan. Currently, PNND is further investigating the ventilation problem or aspects, and we have seen no problem. That's all, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Senator Fisher.
The total cost, Parent, as you see it now, is that what the bond is going to cover? In other words, will the bond cover the cost to do the job without asking additional state revenue?
I am not familiar with the funding, and I'm just looking at the technical question. Private enterprise, we look at construction cost at $16 million. That's a contractor would go in there. That's what he would actually build it for. Okay, allowing for some construction contingency unforeseen, which always come up in a job, and allowing for planning, 20% in that range, you get about a $20 million project. Sir.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much. Next person to testify will be Joe Hayes. Larry Howell from the Alaska Railroad.
Larry.
Thank you very much. My name is Larry Howell. I'm with the Alaska Railroad Corporation. Brief little history here. Both tunnels were completed in 1942. It is a key transportation link for the Alaska Railroad. The Whittier Tunnel is about a 2.5-mile tunnel that was constructed. And both tunnels are horseshoe-shaped, and they're approximately 16 feet wide, 21 feet tall. Just a little something kind of interesting I discovered in the research is that you can tell when the outbreak of World War II happened when the construction of the Whittier Tunnel, because they shut the bore down to a very, very small size the week of December 7th in order to complete the project in time for the military access to Whittier. The Railroad Corporation has no objection to converting the Whittier Tunnel Road to accept automobile traffic, providing that that dual-purpose tunnel is constructed. In fact, we're very, very much in support of a dual-purpose tunnel to Whittier. We do have several concerns. I'd like to comment a little bit on what Mayor Buck stated that with regard to the service to Whittier. I think that she would perhaps testify that since the state has owned the Railroad Corporation, service has certainly increased. And in fact, this year, we will go to 6 trips a day, 7 days a week throughout the summer. So we are working aggressively to enhance the service on today's railroad to the city of Whittier. But back to the concerns that we have over the tunnel. The 8 major concerns, probably the primary one for us is the liability. We would ask the state of Alaska assume the liability for personal injury and property damage related to the public use of the tunnel. Today, we do assume that liability for our own use of that tunnel. But if we were to have the public use of that tunnel, we would ask the state of Alaska, just like a normal highway, would assume that type of liability as well. We would look to the state to indemnify the railroad for claims from the public for rockfall and what would happen through the tunnel. Ventilation is a concern to us. It's a 2.5-mile-long tunnel, and if you've ever followed a train or ridden the shuttle through there, you'll know that it's pretty well smoky, and it takes a while for that to clear out. Given the tunnel tolerances, the ventilation would obviously have to accommodate the rails and the flat cars and the box cars that and the Whittier shuttle operation that does run through there as far as the freight movement. And there's a 21-foot ceiling in there, so there are there are very strict tolerances to work within. Drainage. The tunnel must be designed to avoid standing water in the road section. This is especially needed because at the entrances, for maybe the first 60 feet in from each entrance, is tremendous icing of the tunnel and ice problems because of the poor drainage. The surface of the roadway, we would ask that be constructed with quality materials and leveled with the track to avoid a driving hazard or damage to vehicles. I think there's another concern with regard to lighting. Adequate lighting must be provided to illuminate the obstructions in the roadway, et cetera. Pullouts, we would expect to see some pullouts designed to handle disabled automobiles quickly and safely. Maintenance, the state would maintain the roadway. We would ask the state to maintain that roadway and the tunnel to include the repairs of any rock falls from the roof or the sides of the tunnel. We do have a tremendous maintenance burden in that tunnel as it is today. I think we'd also look for, as far as maintenance, the state to reimburse the railroad for additional costs of repairing or replacing rail. That's a very costly thing to put rail in a level roadbed. And then, of course, the final item would be traffic control. We would ask that the railroad freight, which is a major freight port for us, roll-on, roll-off barges, hydrotrain comes into Whittier. We would ask for priority in tunnel use. Speed limits and the direction of flow for automobiles, we believe, should be rigidly enforced, and that would probably require some type of surveillance available all hours that the tunnel is in use. A lot of these concerns that we bring up are mainly engineering hurdles, and we think that we have a lot of confidence in Perretta Rash Nottingham and Drag. They seem to be a first-class outfit, and we certainly don't have the expertise on staff at the railroad to create a dual-purpose tunnel, but we're confident with PN&D But these are very strict concerns of ours, and would hope that they would be addressed by the engineering firm.
Okay, thank you. Any questions, Senator Fisher?
Do you know what the revenue to the railroad is just for Portage Whittier, not including Anchorage? This is what we're talking about. What revenue did the state railroad get last year from that run?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Fisher, I do not have a revenue breakout of that. I have the vehicle. I just do not have that for specifically relating to the Whittier Tunnel and that transport into Portage. I do have a fee schedule here, and I have the total number of counts by month, but we haven't broken that out. I would be glad to supply that to you. Within the next several days. Once I get back, I can pull that off, that revenue off. It is not a money maker for the railroad, sir.
Do you think that you took in $2 million?
I'm very uncomfortable at giving you a number without really having the information to back it up, and I would just tell you that I will supply those numbers by say Monday of next week. I just don't have a revenue count. Passenger service on the railroad, Mr. Chairman, did take in $6 million in revenues last year, and there was about a $1.1 million loss in the passenger service department. That is my new department, by the way. So.
The reason I raise the question is just the debt service alone would be $2.1 million on the bond, assuming that you sell a $27 million bond. That's why I was wondering. I would hope that it would at least break even.
We haven't looked at the numbers as far as the, you know, we're in support of the dual-purpose tunnel, but as far as the economics of it, the railroad has not explored that on behalf of PN&D or the City of Whittier.
But last question, Mr. Chairman, you would expect that, or at least I'm guessing that you're saying that as you handle a railroad crossing, which the municipality ends up paying for the maintenance of the snow and the sakes, you go to the municipality and do the same thing here. And I know you're going to find snow and tunnel, but if there's some kind of maintenance for the tunnel itself that involves the railroad, do you feel that that should be picked up by the toll or the cost of the road maintenance and not come under your budget?
I think that the current level of maintenance might be imprudent for the railroad to look at our current level of maintenance. Say we are responsible for that railroad-related maintenance. However, when you do run a lot of public cars through there and things, there's going to be a certain amount of road maintenance that would not occur if the road were not there. And I think we would expect the state to pick that maintenance up, sir.
So I guess, so I hear this right, that whatever, say, your average cost of maintenance of the railroad is now, you feel that would be legitimate to apply toward that. Anything in excess of that, then you feel should come out. But you don't expect this to supplant what you normally would do in the railroad.
I think that's fair, sir, yes. Okay. Any other questions? Thank you very much, Larry. Joe Hayes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Joe Hayes, and I'm a lobbyist for the Chugach Alaska Regional Corporation, which is headquartered in Anchorage. One of their board members, John Christensen, was to have been here this morning to testify on behalf of Chugach, but due to some mix-ups in the scheduling, he's not here, so they've asked me to read a short statement from Mr. Christensen in support of this piece of legislation. So if I might have that latitude, I'd like to read about a page and a half into the record on behalf of Chugach Alaska Corporation.
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the Finance Committee. My name is John Christensen, a member of the Board of Directors of Chugach Alaska Corporation. On behalf of our President, Mike Chittick, and Board of Directors, I'm here to convey Chugach Alaska Corporation's support for the passage of House Bill 311, which approves the issuance of revenue bonds for the construction of a road from Portage to Whittier. As the closest harbor in the protected waters of Prince William Sound to the major city of Anchorage, Whittier should be the gateway to the Sound, but falls short due to the lack of regular daily transportation services. It was not until 1983, through a cooperative agreement with the state and Department of Interior and Agriculture, that Chugach Alaska Corporation was able to acquire historic and economically valuable properties in the heart of its region. Since then, the company has built its business enterprises on the development of a natural resource base in fisheries, timber, tourism, and minerals. Last year, Chugach Alaska Corporation chaired the Prince William Sound Tourism Coalition, which we have organized as a charter member in 1987, and this year we have a member on the board of directors. Of all its properties, Chugach views its holdings at Shotgun Cove within the incorporated boundaries of Whittier as having the highest potential for tourism and recreation. This belief is documented by the company's long-term business plan and led to the formation with the City of Whittier of the Shotgun Cove Steering Committee in 1985. This steering committee has guided our participation in final land selections, the Federal Harbor Site Study, State Area Plan, and Municipal Coastal Management Plans. Each of these projects include the road to Whittier and Shotgun Cove as the highest priority. Chugach Alaska Corporation supports the construction of a road from Portage to Whittier, which is included in this bill because it would access a protected harbor, diversify the land use and economy of Whittier, and improve the enjoyment and management of Prince William Sound. Also, the oil spill in March 1989 further amplified the need for additional access to Prince William Sound. Thank you for hearing this bill and considering our testimony on its behalf. We look forward to working with the legislature on this and other projects that affect the region and state as a whole. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Hayes. Next person to testify on 311 is Senator Jones. Did he come up yet? I thought I saw him in the very back. He likes to sit in the back. Senator Jones.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The other part of this bill, of course, is the Bradfield Road project. This road comes into southern southeast Alaska, just about equidistant between Wrangell and Ketchikan. It comes in at about midway between a DOT recognized transportation hard link corridor between Wrangell and Ketchikan. It goes from salt water 29 miles to the border, Canadian border, which is about 12 miles between that and the termination of a road from Bob Quinn Lake on the Cassiar Highway in British Columbia. This road is, the Canadian road is being started this fall with a contract that's been let for about 3-4 miles of the first part of that road. The Canadians expect to be up into the mining district, the Iskut River mining district, and allowing access to those mines with a service road by the end of this year. A very aggressive program on their part. A lot of this stems from the difficulty of flying supplies in and out of that area. They've just recently, you may have read it in the newspaper, lost some people on a helicopter trying to move them in and out of those mining sites. It's a very difficult area to service. There is a mine, an operating mine right now, the Johnny Mountain Mine. It's a gold, real high quality gold mine in that area. They're flying supplies and people in and out of Wrangell, utilizing the Wrangell Airport as a base of operations. They fly ore out and they fly fuel and ore supplies and people in. This road allows a lot of that rock in the Iskut mining area to become ore because it provides a direct route to salt water. Once we establish the fact that we will go ahead with the road, then we have the opportunity to sit down with the mining companies in those areas and talk to them about tolls. This is a toll road. This will be a toll road. It probably more than any I've seen has the possibility of being just that and paying for itself because of the minerals and the timber resources that the Canadians have in that area and the desire they have to develop those resources. They are smart enough to know that the shortest route to salt water for those resources is through the Bradfield. The Bradfield Road is the last access available to southern southeast out to British Columbia and the rest of the road system in North America. All the other access routes have been blocked by wilderness areas or monuments or some type of land use set aside that disallows us to have any other connection. The Bradfield is the last one. I think it's important that we take advantage of this. The BC government is supportive. They have said David Parker from the Crown Lands Minister was here, testified in the Resource Committee that it's a development they'd like to see go ahead. And it's just a natural step for them to connect that road, the road they're building now, on up to the border and connect with us. So I urge support for this bill.
Senator Duncan.
Just a couple questions. Senator Jones, let's see, it's $23 million for that, or $22 million, I guess, for Bradfield. Have all the EIS, has it been an EIS and all those things that are done? I'm assuming on any road project you need to do those types of, so is that funding included in this $22 million, or how does that come about?
A partial funding. We have already started the EIS procedure. We had some funds put in last year, Senator Duncan. that got the, has started the ball rolling with the EIS. They're having hearings right now. I think the last one is just due shortly on that process. And it takes about another $100,000, $150,000 to finish that, the total EIS. And I believe it's in the funding. I'd have to check that out. I know the engineering, Senator, is included, but I'm not positive the rest of the EIS money is.
What, Matt, what's the, assuming that everything goes around in EIS, and I have no indication, I don't know what the preliminary results have been. Has there been any problem identified with the construction of this route?
Not that I know of. As a matter of fact, there's been a letter to the department from SEAC that was, didn't, you know, fully support, but they didn't object, let's put it that way.
That's pretty good.
Well, it's a better alternative than building the road up the Stikine River or the Unuk River or, you know, some other area that they desire to protect.
May I ask one other question?
Senator.
What would be the, assuming the EIS, and I assume if you got another $150,000 worth of EIS to do, that's another year, or a year and a half, or whatever. What's the time frame on a project like this? When do they expect to start construction, and how does that tie in with the mine development, et cetera?
Well, it would be, to build this road, you could build the road in one season, and if you got in and really hit it hard. So we'd like to see it in the next, completed within the next 3 years. So we need to, the EIS, is, like I said, has started. We're looking probably another 6 to 8 months of work to complete that.
And then one further question, so I understand. What standards is a road like this built to? Is it built to?
This standard is the same as you would find in a resource or a haul road, the spec one road in on a Forest Service, National Forest land. It's a one lane road with intervisible turnouts. So, but it's a well built road. The tunnel is a full federal highway standard tunnel, 6,300 foot tunnel. And it's built so that we don't have to, when it becomes a federal highway, which we fully expect it to become, because it will be a route connecting up with the highway system. And we don't want to have to go in and rebuild that tunnel because it's very expensive to do that.
Okay, but then, Mr. Chairman, if I might, initially, I guess, it's not going to be open to general public for travel or not?
Initially, it will not, because it only connects really into a resource area and would be a resource road. But I would have to say that shortly after that, you're going to see pressure for public access, Senator. As you well know, that's generally what happens, especially when it's connected like it will be. And eventually, I see the area being serviced through the ferry system. It's a natural route between Wrangell and Ketchikan to stop a ferry in there, and could benefit really that system.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, the reason I was asking that question is I'm wondering, just because we're all in the same region, southeast region, as far as federal highway dollars go, I'm just wondering what the impact might be on those allocations in the future when that pressure does come to bring it up to federal highway standards. I'm assuming then that the tolls will not pay for that, but it would be, or will they? I mean, or will we be then looking to take a special allocation out of the federal dollars in order to upgrade it and maintain it?
I see tolls being a source of income that the federal government will even recognize and play a part in. If you notice, President Bush just put out a statement on transportation emphasizing the toll road concept throughout the nation, and that we need to start looking more and more toward that concept. And I think that, yes, the toll road will play a big part in helping pay for it.
I just, DOT is not here, are they?
Yeah, they are.
Well, they are here? Oh, I see Keith. Okay, I could ask Keith that same question.
Listen. Any other questions for Senator Jones? Senator Fisher, Senator Frank?
Do you envision any of the power part being picked up by this road?
Well, it's an important route also for the utilities. We've had requests from the mines for power. They have to use diesel power at this time. Of course, they'd love to tie into a hydro project and receive their power from the Tai Lake Power Project. and there's been a the route identified as the same route as the, which the road travels through. Those permits are in hand. There's a private firm in Wrangell that has this has these permits at this time, and they're ready to move. So yes, it would be, and it could at one time. The BC Hydropower is within about 120 miles of the Iskut River at this time, and with more development taking place in the Iskut River area, they are looking at extending those power lines into the Iskut, which could allow us to tie in eventually with hydroelectric power from BC. A very cheap source of power, by the way.
Senator Fisher?
Are you saying, Senator, that some of the cost of the power project can be picked up by the revenue bond?
No. No, the power project is a separate project, and that's being handled through a private firm at this time.
Any other questions for Senator Jones?
Yes.
Senator Frank?
Senator Jones, are these mines are mostly gold mines, or?
Right at this time, yes, the gold mines are the ones that are being developed because of, of course, the high value. With a road access, you're looking at huge deposits of copper. And like I said, it turns a lot of rock into ore when you provide that access. I think one of the largest copper deposits in the world is sitting there close to this area.
So, I mean, I guess it seems like if you're talking about gold, you can usually take the gold out pretty easily because it's such, you know, high value and small, even, you know. So, but if you're talking copper, then you have to ship the ore out, and that's been prohibitively expensive at this point. So it's copper that really would be, as far as transportation of ore, I suppose, obviously it'll help transportation of materials and supplies into the mines, into the gold mines, and then on the copper, are there companies that are actively seeking to develop them, that have the claims and want to develop them?
Yes, there are, Senator. I don't know if you have this feasibility, but in here it tells all the companies that are...
I see. Okay.
I'll let you take that. I thought the committee had a copy of that.
Any other questions?
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Jones. Next person to testify is... did Mr. Gerken want to come up for a minute? There may be a question on the... Senator Duncan has on the DOC.
Just a couple quick questions, if I could, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Keith, a couple questions. One, I don't see a position paper. Is DOT supporting both these projects, however?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Duncan, yes, we are supporting both these projects.
Okay. So the other question I had then was, how do you see the Bradfield River Resource Road specifically here, as I understand from Senator Joe's testimony, is going to be a one-lane traffic initially, not up to standards, not up to any federal standards, et cetera. But his comment was that at some point we would probably want to expand that to federal standards because of the public pressure of the access, which probably makes sense. How do you see that being funded? How does that impact the rest of federal allocations to Southeast? Have you looked that far down the road?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Duncan, that's obviously calls for some speculation. At the moment, the critical components of the road, both the tunnel and the bridges, would be built to a federal secondary standard, and those are the most expensive pieces. Under the current federal highway funding rules, if it were not open to the public and if it had a toll, it would not be eligible for federal funding. That program is going to be completely rewritten, according to the federal government, in 1991. And as Senator Jones pointed out, the President and Secretary Skinner's impetus is to have users pay more of the cost of new transportation improvements, including toll roads. It is likely that the new bill will at least be more flexible and probably will allow toll roads, probably not a lack of public access, but toll roads on roads which use federal highway funds to build them. So I assume that that would be in the future. It's likely to assume that would be a source of improvement money. The other option is that the toll, which would, I believe, annually be readjusted based upon volume and revenue and expense, be increased in order to also accumulate a capital fund for those improvements as well. That will really depend upon the extent to which that resource development grows, or the extent to which public access is allowed and increases those tolls. The other source of funding is, if it is our regular highway funding under the current
even under a new program, it's going to compete against other projects in Southeast or in the rest of the state. Our concern about that at the moment would be that under the new federal program, we're not overly ambitious that we're going to get any more money, and at least some of the proposals that have been put on the table in Washington, D.C. would have us getting less, which is going to make it harder to do that work with those dollars.
Senator Fisher.
The toll itself, is that funded by the DOT if there's a toll road set up?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Fisher, since we don't have one, there are a couple options. I mean, I can't say that I know that that would be the case. I think that's certainly the most likely option. The other option is that an actual separate toll authority be created. In any case, the funds would have to be accounted for separately somehow. Who collects them is, I think, more or less a mechanical process, but they will have to be accounted for separately in order for the retirement of those bonds.
No matter who it is, whether it's an authority or what, the rate would have to also justify. I mean, you'd have to set a rate to pay back the line of debt. Also, you see that the rate also has to pick up the maintenance on that particular toll road, which means that you can't even negotiate because you have to recover. If you keep holding the bond, you're going to want to see on this particular road, they're going to want to see the $2.3 million a year coming in on toll. So somebody's got to figure out the rate to cover that. How about the other
costs?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Fisher, I think that again goes back to the question about whether or not it is essentially a resource development road or whether it's also open to the public. I think as long as it was a deal negotiated between the state and the users of that road, that you would probably look to those users to either pay that cost or maintain it themselves, or to include that cost in a toll, or for us to come to the legislature and ask for that money. I think certainly once you put public traffic on it, it becomes more incumbent upon the state to cover that maintenance cost. I think at the moment, all it should be obligated to raise would be the cost to repay those bonds. The purpose of the dollars in our fiscal note are for us to do, as required by statute, a toll feasibility report. That report would lay out all those options about our estimated volume of traffic and what we believe they would pay as a toll. And ultimately, you have to look at how much you think you can raise by the various methods and what the cost of that project is, and this is our cost system. And if you can believe that the market will bear a toll that will pay both the capital and the operating, that is certainly, I think, the kind of arrangement that the state would try to negotiate with those resource users.
Senator Duncan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Keith, just back on one other question I'd had of Senator Jones. I wonder if you could talk just a little bit about the EIS, the status of that right now, and what you expect that to be done. And also, if I could just get you maybe to do a little comparison, we're also doing an EIS on access into this community. And it seems like the one down in the Wrangell area may be a little bit easier to do than this one. I'm wondering if you could give me any idea if that's the case and the reasons why, if that's true.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Duncan, they're very different. It's hard to compare them. The EIS process on the Juneau Access Study, I think, is probably a little bit farther along. I think we've had probably a longer history of studies, and we've had more meetings done. The EIS on the Bradfield Road, we spent a lot of time initially because at that point, and it gets a little complicated here, we had to deal with a different federal process in that one. We had to deal through the State Department because the federal highway was not, when you don't have a federal agency to sponsor EIS, you have to go get the State Department to tell the Forest Service how they should deal with the Canadian government because it goes up to the border. That whole process took a lot longer, so we're not as far along in it. It is, in a lot of ways, though, an easier study because there are fewer options. In the Juneau Access Study, we're looking at many, many options of different routes and ferry system improvements. There are more communities affected. So, I mean, in that sense, the Bradfield EIS is probably in its substance. I mean, if you look at it in the thickness, it'll probably be a thinner report than the Juneau Access Study. But the process of any EIS these days, no matter how simple the project, we simply can't do any of them in less than a year with the public hearings and all the procedural steps that you go through. In terms of time, they're probably going to get done about the same time. Both of them, I believe, are only partially funded, so we're looking for more money for both of those to complete that work.
Senator Jones could put enough money in the budget to cover both of them?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know.
I was just kidding.
Thank you. Are there any more questions? Okay, thank you, Keith. Anybody else here that wants to testify on House Bill 311? Okay, I don't think, unless there's any more discussion on it, Senator Frank or Senator Duncan, did you want to make a motion to move it out?
I just had one question for Keith. I apologize for being so slow to react, but could you come back up, Keith? And I haven't had a chance to look at the whole thing here, but how much of this mineral development, in your opinion, is dependent on, or let me put it a different way, how much of the feasibility of this road from an economic standpoint is dependent upon new mines and the hauling of ore as opposed to the hauling of supplies? I mean, are we going to see a situation where we have ore trucks running back and forth, or are we going to see a situation where the road is primarily used to supply mines?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Frank, my sense of that, and I'm not a mining consultant, I think the people that put that report together are certainly more knowledgeable about than I, but my reading of it would say that a road will allow things to happen that won't otherwise happen. And if the road were there, you would see a number of resources being hauled, not just the supply of what is currently happening. I think you also would probably see that even some more of what is currently happening would happen simply because only the highest grade, richest deposits, even in gold, can afford to fly in and out the concentrates as they're doing now. But I think that the principal use of the road would be in hauling materials that were extracted, and timber as well. I believe in one of those reports, a fairly extensive chart of current mining claims and resource analyses on both sides of the border in that whole area. And as Senator Jones pointed out, a road could go either way. It's really up to the developers and the Canadian government to decide whether or not what is, in any business sense, the most viable and efficient access is to come this direction to water via this road. I mean, they can go to the Canadian highway and truck whatever they're going to take out a significantly longer distance. If they were to make that decision, there'd probably be fewer resource extraction projects that were economically viable.
You mean because of a greater toll required, or just a greater distance?
The greater hauling distance.
Okay. Okay. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator Fisher.